Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPM, and All GTLD PDP Working Group call held on the 17th of January, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll calls. We have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. Currently at this time, on audio only, we have Brian Beckham. In addition to Brian, is anyone else on the telephone only? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, J. Scott Evans. Please begin.
Thank you very much, Terry. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, everyone, depending on your location. This is J. Scott Evans for the record. I will be chairing today's call. And just to remind everyone, it was covered in the memo that sent out with our agenda by Mary, but to remind you all, there will be no call on January 24th due to staff obligations on an internal meeting they have to have, which will make them unavailable even in the evening time. We thought about moving our Asia Pacific call, but it turns out the staff's obligations go well into the evening, so we would have no staff support. So just want to put that on for the record. Excuse me. At this time, I think it is appropriate just to check in real quick to see if anyone has an update to their statement of interest. Okay. Hearing none. As you can see, the agenda is posted in the pod or window to the right-hand side of the Adobe Connect, and we are going to start today with a presentation on the information, the data that's been collected and updated on URS cases that's been put together by staff, particularly Barry has put this together for us. And so I'm going to turn it over to Barry for his presentation, and then once that's finished, we'll continue on through the agenda. Barry?
Thank you, J. Scott. Welcome, everybody. I'm just going to run through the PDF that you see in the Adobe Connect room. This was also sent along with the agenda last night, and this is a continuation of pretty much the same presentation that heard in Abu Dhabi. The difference between this version and the prior version is that it first contains data to the conclusion of 2017. It also contains changes due to some feedback from that session as well. So I'm just going to run through pretty much each page. I'll pause for a second after this, the second page is on down to see if there are any questions. And we'll get through this and then be able to continue on the agenda. So starting on page one, this particular page really hasn't changed from the first version. This is still just a general graph and table of the TLDs that were delegated over each of the last years up till now. It hasn't changed because since the last presentation, there hasn't been any other new GTLDs or GTLDs from the 2012 round that have been delegated. And it's really just for use with reference and to put into context of the state of the activity and the deployment of the new GTLDs. I'm going to move on down now to page two, which gets into the URS definition, the resource documents, when the three providers were announced to start conducting URS case reviews. And the really two takeaways from this page are down towards the bottom under data set characteristics. First is the scope, which is bullet number two. As I mentioned, this now includes data from to the conclusion of 2017. The prior version had halted at June 30th of 2017. However, there are 12 cases at the time that I collected the raw data from the provider sites that were still in pending status. So it's technically not all data of cases concluded in 2017, and it just depends on whether these 12 were finally wrapped up at the end of 2017 or if the decision date, if it falls into January of 2018, then that's when they'll be picked up. I suspect that the next time we go through to up this data will be closer. Well, it'll be on two different aspects. One, if the working group feels they need a refresh data set, but most likely I suspect we'll refresh this data as we get closer to publishing an initial report or something along those lines. Just like the first version, the third bulleted item, there are a few cases that are for other TLDs not associated with the 2012 round. Those cases, because they were completed, are included in the raw data set, but they do not they are filtered out from any of the actual numbers or charts that we are presented here. Moving on to page three, first table is just a high-level table of all the URS cases. Essentially, there are 827 cases now across 1,861 domains. There is a typo in the first table that's supposed to say 2.25 or 2.25 average domains per case with a still a median of one. That was an error due to the track changes within the Word document. When we repost this to the wiki, I'll make sure that typo is corrected. The second table is just a distribution of the cases by provider. I believe that there were one or two from the ADN DRC. The bulk of changes for the last half of 2017 were with Forum, and I believe that there were no changes from MFSD. In short, there were really, for the last half of 2017, just shy of 80 total cases that were new into this data set. And I'll stop right here. Jay Scott, please go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question with regards to the data set characteristics bullet point three. You mentioned that these cases that you've listed here aren't included in the cumulative data. But my question is, how did a .pro or a .cn have a URS applied against it, since these only apply to new TLDs that were delegated during the round? I see when you say withdrawn, I assume that was mistakenly done, but for .pro, I see two cases, and it says one was suspended and one was denied. So I'm just, and then for .pw, did they sign up to voluntarily to be included in the URS, or are these just aberrations?
Thank you, Jay Scott. For the .cn and .pw TLDs, I can't confirm when they contracted amongst that country code TLD to provide services. But they are included in the raw data or are presented on the provider sites. The .com one was withdrawn. I believe that this was an error because there was another domain that was associated with it. As for .pro, if you'll recall, and I don't remember the exact date, but the .pro registry agreement was renegotiated with ICANN that does now include the URS capability within that agreement. That occurred sometime in early 2017, and once those occurred, there were two cases that were filed for the .pro TLD, one of which resulted in a suspension, and then the other case was denied. The reasoning for them being filtered out is, I think, our scope for Scope 1 URS review is only for typically the 2012 round or the new GTLDs, and hence why they're filtered out of our stats below.
Thank you.
All right, great. We're on page four. Okay. Yes, we'll be moving on to page four, which is just table three, chart two. I think the biggest change from the prior version, which is really an oversight on my part, but when we're looking at the raw data that has been scraped from the provider sites, it is by cases, and there are cases that do have multiple domains. When I imported that data into my current spreadsheet, I actually created it on a per domain level and not on a per case level, because we wanted to extract statistics about the domains themselves, regardless of whether they were included with other domains in that review. There was a feedback that we got from Abu Dhabi that it was much more meaningful to have these tables and charts put together on a case basis. And thus, this is just a different version of the kind of the same data set, but is now just by cases. And the takeaway here is just to see the number of cases that were filed or commenced per year. The main takeaway here is you'll see that there is a downward trend from the quantity of cases filed in 2014 to what we see now in 2017. And again, understand that small caveat that there could be at least 12 more added to this 2017 number, depending on what the end result of those cases will be. And whenever we do go to update this data set, as I mentioned earlier, the 2017 number is slightly going to change. But the other takeaway, again, is that clearly Forum is the predominant provider here. Okay, I'll move along to page five. This is a very busy page with more charts. And I'm hopeful that most of this group has had time to read this in detail. But it's very important to look at the note or the paragraph above these two tables. The original intent of this, from the first version, the original intent was to show the number of domains per TLD that showed up within cases. And so the first change that you're seeing here is that now we're actually looking at this by the number of cases in the table to the left versus the number of domains, which is the table to the right. The secondary change here is that there was feedback in Abu Dhabi as well to understand if the commencement date of the URS case actually fell within the trademark claims windows as defined by the registries. And so that is now this attempt. So as listed in the note as an example, just looking at XYZ, there were a total of 69 cases filed for XYZ domains. Only two of those 69 showed up within their defined trademark claims window. And then looking at it at the detail of domains, there were only, which is to the table to the right, there were a total of 582 domains within those 69 cases. Only two of those domains actually showed up within their defined 90 days trademark claims window. So the intent was to try to get an idea of when the commencement date occurred within their defined windows. However, I think that this table should probably, or at least it'd be my recommendation, it's up to the working group, it doesn't serve the intent of truly understanding of whether a claims notification actually resulted in either a URS or a UDRP. And technically, we're really trying to go back to some of the prior deliberations under the stream or the path of talking about the trademark claims and Sunrise and that component. So what staff is working on is to get a fresh data set from IBM, which will show when a claims notification was sent for a particular TLD. And then as part of the technical specification, when a domain is actually registered after the claims is presented, it will also in that logging show that the particular second level domain was indeed registered. So when we get a fresh data set from IBM, I'll be able to go back and look at the actual domains that were registered, and then I can go back and compare that domain list with the domains identified in these URS cases, and we'll be able to get to a specific number. Staff made the decision here to go ahead and present this data because it was asked by the working group. Again, just to close out, I would suggest that we do away with this chart and look to better find the path that I just discussed to get to that definitive number instead of this. And so probably a future version will still have these two tables, but it'll just be a single column, or well, it'll be two columns, by TLD, the number of cases, by TLD, the number of domains, and move on from there. Any questions or comments before I move on from this page? I know it's a pretty crowded or noisy type of table to understand. Okay. Moving along now, which I believe will become page 7, which is table 6 and eventually chart 3. This is going to be even more complicated than the prior charts or tables, is because this is a compilation from the prior version of this document that was 3 or 4 tables and charts. And based on feedback from not only the co-chairs in reviewing this, but across a few comments in Abu Dhabi, it was difficult to compare basically the outcome type with the actual determination. And so the idea was to consolidate this into one master table and chart. I'll quickly just point to you on the next page, on page 8, is kind of a visual representation of what the table displays on page 7. And what you'll see here, column 1 is essentially kind of titled as category, with the top level row being kind of the outcome type. And then there's subcategories behind that or below it, which are the determination type. So, for example, if the domain was suspended, then there was a determination type of either default, final, or a combination of default, final, and I'll talk about that in a little bit detail in a minute. But essentially, you have primary categories, secondary categories of the determination type as you move down. And then the columns to the right that are in white and gray are basically subtotals as you roll up these numbers. And what's behind this is basically creating what Microsoft Excel calls pivot tables. And I think I mentioned this in Abu Dhabi. It's kind of a poor man's version of a relational database, and that's what pivot tables provide you, is to analyze rows and columns of various data sets and attempt to make meaning of them. So we kept column A or column 1 the same exact result or these subcategory tags as what you would find in the chart. And then on the last column is an attempt to make a more detailed description of what these subcategories actually mean. I won't go through all of these in detail, but I will provide an example. So we'll just start at the top, which is suspended and default. So essentially the takeaway for this area or for this subcategory under domains that were suspended and had a default determination, there were 531 cases that had a default suspension. And then there's a breakout in the columns to the left of the grand total is by provider. Of those 531 cases, one of those were appealed based on that original default determination. And then, again, over to the right is just a kind of an attempt to further explain what each one of those rows means. If we were to step down into the final subcategory, there were 178 cases that had an outcome where the domain was suspended. But what's different from the default is that the registrant had responded to that case, and of those 178, 10 of those were appealed. And I'd just like to point out that on both of these subcategories, default or final, there's this indication of blank. And the reason why that is showing up is because in the raw data, there is no data in that field. And thus, the pivot table will just default mark this blank indication. But at the end of the day, when you see a row where it has the blank, and here is that this basically means 168 of these domains that were suspended still had a final determination of final determination, meaning that the registrant did respond and that there was no appeal from that, whereas conversely, the row before it is that there were 10 appeals of domains that still have a final determination. And then lastly, within this subcategory is the default final. Within I believe it's the procedures, the examiner has the option to publish both outcomes of that particular case. So, Mary or staff can correct me if I mess this up, but in general, if the case is filed, there's a default determination. At some point, the registrant does respond. And then eventually through that response is still a final determination. The examiner is making the choice to publish both of those on the provider site. And the details of that can be found within the URS procedures. But essentially all of these are from Forum, 14 of those cases resulted in this default final. And essentially, if you were to click on the links for each one of those, they present themselves as they're the same case number, but when you look at the URL, they have a different letter denoting the difference between the default version versus the final version where the registrant had responded. I won't spend much more time on these, but again, you can see there's a subsection for where the claims were denied. There was a subsection where there's a split decision, which means that there was a final determination on a case. It was appealed. That appeal resulted in a split decision. And then the last section is the complaint withdrawn. And I'll just scroll down to what is page 8, which again is just a visual representation of the previous chart. And then we've also attached definitions for the outcome types and the determination types. And that basically flows over to the bottom or to the top of page 9. And then I'll just conclude and turn this back over to you, Jay Scott. The very last table is just a gauge of the average duration from the commencement date to the decision date by provider, with a total average of 17.39 days. Happy to answer any questions or if there's concerns about how this data is presented, and certainly look forward to any other suggestions on this data. Thank you, Jay Scott.
Thank you, Barry. I'm in the queue first, and I see Susan Payne and Kathy Kleiman. I wonder if it might not be easier if, rather than leaving blank, since blank, as I understood your explanation, indicates that there was no appeal filed, that rather than just leaving it blank, you put no appeal. So you got no appeal in one category, one subcategory, and appeal in another category. I'm wondering if that might assist in alleviating some of the confusion. Barry, I see your hand is up.
Yes, thank you, Jay Scott. Mary had the exact same feedback, and I resisted. But at the end, I'll change based on the working group's feedback. So the reason I was hesitant to do exactly what you just said, and why we added this last column of description, is because if, for example, under suspended default, and I can't tell if it's synced or not, but I'm back on the table on page 7. If I were to go back and say no appeal and exchange no appeal with the term blank there, for me to remove that in the graph, which is presented on page 8, I've got to go change the actual raw data. And I didn't want to do that because I'm trying to stay true to the raw data that is presented on the provider's site, and thus why we created the description column. So for that blank row of 530 cases, it's a default determination, i.e. without a response or an appeal. And so it is truly up to the working group how you think this is best to present it, but the rationale, again, was just to not modify the raw authoritative data from the providers.
Thanks, Barry. I see Susan Payne and then Kathy Kleiman.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Susan, it's just a really quick question about the final table, which, oh, sorry, hang on. That's better. Sorry about that. The final table, which is the one about the duration, it's just a really quick question. Does that, if there was an appeal, does that include the time the cases, does it include the time taken to get to appeal for cases where there was an appeal, or is it just time to first decision?
Thank you, Susan. I'm going to have to come back with you for an authoritative answer to that. Right now, all I have is what is provided from the data scraped off of the provider site, which basically has the commencement date and the decision date. There are so very few many appeals in the grand scheme of the 827 cases. My instinct would say that if it's not included, that these duration averages wouldn't change much. But I will take the action to go back and just confirm, just to make sure that we're squared up on that.
Okay, thanks. And yeah, I guess as you say, maybe it's unlikely to make a significant difference to the average. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Kathy?
Hi, Jay Scott. This is Kathy Kleiman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Barry, first, thank you for all the work you put into this table and for listening to comments in Abu Dhabi. and then coming back. Really appreciate it. First, some procedural things, and then I have a more substantive question. One is you keep referring to page numbers. I just want to let you know I printed it out, and I'm looking at it on the screen. I don't see any page numbers. So it might be a good idea to put page numbers in, but in the meantime, if you could refer to the title of the chart that you're talking about, it would certainly help me follow you through the discussion, especially if we're going to, you know, have questions and jump around. Looking at what I think is page 7, the chart titled Table 6, Chart 3, I wanted to ask you about default determinations. Would it be worth dropping a footnote here to 6.3 of the URS procedure that says all default cases proceed to examination for review on the merits of the claim? So these aren't automatic losses, and as we'll see, even in default, lower down on the chart, even when there are default cases, sometimes there are decisions in favor of the registrant, which is really interesting. My question for you has to do with the next section of the URS rules and where those are reflected in the chart. So 6.4 of the URS procedure says, if after examination in default cases, so if after examination in cases where the registrant has not shown up, often probably because they don't have notice, but other reasons as well, the examiner rules in favor of the complainant, registrant shall have the right to seek relief from default via de novo review, not an appeal, but de novo review, by filing a response at any time up to 6 months after the date of the notice of default. So I'm wondering how many registrants did that? How many filed within 6 months after default via the de novo review? Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm going to attempt to answer this, but I will lean on Mary and other staff to correct me if I'm wrong. Is looking at this data, first, I don't believe, again, and this is only as scraped off of the search pages from the provider's site, I don't believe that this necessarily will specifically state which aspect of these cases contained the de novo review, as you mentioned in the URS rules. However, the fact that the way this information is presented on the provider sites is that if there's a final determination or an appeal or the default final, and through any of these numbers means that there was some sort of response in general by the registrant. I think that to understand exactly whether the registrant responded within the 14 days or after the 14 days and up to 6 months, or if they tried to make an extension from that first 6 months, that will require a review of those individual cases themselves where there was some sort of final determination or appeal as tagged from the data. From this particular data set, I don't think we'll get to that kind of level of granularity. And I'm going to turn it over to Mary to hopefully correct me if I messed up.
Wait. So, Bear, you're saying it's not available, but the decisions aren't saying whether it was a whether the registrant responded, but responded in the longer window.
Hi, Kathy. Just before I turn it to Mary, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the way that the data is presented off of the search pages that basically will show all of the cases on the provider site, it does not. I believe that if we were to go look at the actual individual cases and clicked on the links and reviewed the case, that we could make a determination whether it was a response within the 14 days or the de novo review before 6 months. And then we could, if we were to review the individual cases, we could add this to the data set and then get those rolled up, but it's not automatically presented by the providers for the way that you're looking for.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Barry. And just one editorial comment that's gone on in the this is Jay Scott for the record, in the as George pointed out and I backed up, I believe it's safe to assume that there were at least 14 cases, Kathy, where that has occurred, because in a case where both the default decision and the final decision was published by the examiner, it's an assumption, but I think it's safe to assume that they got a default judgment and then they responded after that, so that would be outside the 14 days and within the 6 months. So we know at least in 14, but if they didn't publish both, it would be included in that number up there or in the appeals number, and we wouldn't know. So unless we, but I think we can assume that at least 14 times it occurred. Mary, I'm going to jump to you, and then I'm going to go to Zach.
Thanks, Jay Scott. And I just raised my hand from staff to back up what Barry has said, that the data that we got is categorized as you see it. So it's categorized by really the nature of the determination and the result. And so the nature of the determination is whether it was a default determination, meaning there was no response filed before the determination was made, or a final determination, which means a response was filed at some point, or an appeal decision. So if we go to the final determination category, that's what Barry was saying, that when we look at the cases themselves, we can see the dates when these were filed, the responses, that is, and from there we can derive whether or not those responses were filed within the 14-day window, after the 14-day window, with or without an extension. But the data itself, as categorized at the moment, does not show that. So hopefully that underscores what Barry says. Thanks, Jay Scott.
Thank you, Mary. I'm going to move to Zach Muscovich, who has raised his hand.
Thank you. Zach Muscovich. Just to reiterate what Kathy had mentioned, this is a tremendously helpful chart and data set which you provided, Barry. I wanted to ask about one aspect of it. Since the chart, for example, Table 6 is supposed to itemize and tabulate results from the URS, should it also include one of the alternative results, which is an abusive complaint or a complaint where the panel was found that the party made a material falsehood? And I understand that the results were culled from the provider's websites. And when I ran that result on NAF, I saw that there were no results that had that finding. But nevertheless, it is a data point that if there were zero findings, that may be an indication that all of the complaints, even ones that were denied, were meritorious. Or it might be that the panels didn't accurately make that finding or didn't properly consider it. So I think it's another data point which we could include in the chart, even if currently, based upon the grand total of 827 cases, there were zero such findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. I'm going to go to Mary Wong, whose hand is up again.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Thank you, Zach. And now it's my turn to ask Barry to correct me if I get it wrong. Again, this is something that on the face of the data, we could not tell. And therefore, without going further, either to request the information from the providers if they have it, or by looking at the face of the case report itself, we did not have. But it can be derived, because if you look at a lot of the cases, and as George pointed out in the notes, it is not a great deal, that many cases necessarily, that you can find that the examiners do generally note whether or not there was indeed that kind of material falsehood or abuse. So by looking at the face of the case, that is one way to derive the information, but it is not the information based on the data that we were able to get at this point.
Thank you, Mary. Are there any further questions for Barry regarding this information that we see provided here?
Jay Scott Evans, would I be able just to follow up on that with Mary?
Is that Zach? Certainly.
Thank you so much. So when I looked at the NAF website, which has the system for searching cases by inputting various parameters, one of them for the URS was abusive complaints. And so if you tick that box, you can actually get a result of apparently how many URS cases had a finding of abuse in them. And so the result came out as zero from that. So it seems to be a data set that is readily available without actually reviewing the cases themselves. And it's a data point that is independent of whether or not such findings should or should not have been made. It's just a factual number. Apparently it's zero, assuming that the system properly tracked that criteria. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. I think, see Barry's hand is up.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Just to respond to Zach, you're right. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to quickly share my screen. I think in the first version of this, I tried to provide a PDF of the raw data. So when we're pulling this data, and I know that this will probably be difficult for you to see in detail, but essentially when we pull the data from the provider sites, we're just doing a search for all of the data to get to all of the cases that exist out there. And there's only a limited amount of data that is presented in that, and thus that we're seeing the scrape. And I've also added to the data set. So for instance, way over here in column A is all of the cases by forum. The case number, case name, and disputed domain names are fields that would be presented. To get to the by the TLD, I had to split apart all of the domain names and then extract that out or text a column to get to the just the TLD. And the whole idea is to split this apart again so that it shows up or that I can produce these pivot tables to make this sense. What I have listed here, which would be the outcome type and the determination, are provided from the provider sites. The commencement date and decision dates show up in that query, at least for forum. For the other two providers, they would only provide the commencement date. Fortunately, there wasn't a whole bunch of those, so I went into each decision or each case to pull out the decision date where one existed. And then, of course, from there, then I start to extract out, what's the commencement year, what's the duration, and those are calculations in the spreadsheet so that I can then roll that up. In terms of going through and searching the provider sites for this abuse mechanism that you're mentioning, I think that in general we probably need to understand from the working group what are all of those different specific asks, and if not doing it through the URS case review or us by staff going out to the provider sites, or thirdly asking the providers to provide that information, let's get that set of criteria that we need to extract from these cases, and then we can either add it to this data set or bring in a secondary data set so that we have better visibility into these issues that you're looking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Any further questions, thoughts, concerns? Claudio.
Thank you. So my question was just whether if additional issues come up, is staff available to do additional research? I know Rebecca offered to do some, but I was just curious, is staff able to continue to help us out with getting data? Thank you.
Mary.
Thanks, J. Jay Scott, and thanks, Claudio, for the question. And I'll note for the record for those who are not in the Adobe that, Claudio, I think this follows up on the question you had in the chat as to whether the data collection is a one-time exercise or is that something that can be ongoing. And as I think everyone knows, we don't currently have a mechanism where we collect information in any uniform, standardized way across all the providers on an ongoing basis. So as I noted in the chat, this is something the working group may wish to consider, whether it's for the URS or any other of the RPMs that you may be considering in this PDP, to have that done, not just on a regular basis, but done in a consistent and uniform manner so that you're not having to reinvent the wheel, you know, the next time a review like this comes along. To respond to your follow-up question, there are, of course, issues with bandwidth and resource capacity. So what staff is working on with the co-chairs, and Rebecca has been part of that discussion as well through the research that she is doing, is the type of research and review of the data that we currently have, of the cases that you might consider something you want to study, how best to do that, who would be best placed to do that, and as Barry mentioned earlier, what would be the kinds of fields or reporting elements that should be extracted from that kind of research and review of the data that would be of most use to the working group. So it's under discussion, but if you or the working group have suggestions on how that can be done, who might be best placed to do it, and specifically, what is the type of fields or elements that you would like to see? I think that would be very helpful to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. I appreciate that that information. And you can see that I think the whole idea is this is a work in process, and there may be things that we find that we need additional points on, but we do have to take into account that there are bandwidth issues on staff, and so we need to be very cognizant of that. That's not, in other words, what I'm trying to say is, yes, there's additional research that can be done. The question is, should it be done given staff resources, timeline, the way it affects our timeline to come to our decision and those and provide our report and those kinds of things will all have to be brought in as we consider. Hopefully, we'll make a broad enough pass on this as we go. I think with regards to Zach's point, as I understand from reading the chat, it may not be that this type of information is easily searchable and scrapable from each provider's site. That does not mean that that isn't an interesting point that needs to be explored when we look at the cases. And so we may want to actually look at those cases and put that as a field of consideration. So just because it's not in this table doesn't mean necessarily that it is a point that will not be considered in the final analysis. So that, I hear no more questions. I see no more hands. Let me scroll just to make, oh, Susan Payne is raising her hand.
Sorry. I know it's early days for making recommendations and things, but I mean, it seems a reasonable one that we could kind of agree and capture now that or at least let, you know, if people think it's a reasonable thing to recommend. You know, Mary's made a couple of comments about the lack of standardized data coming from the providers. And obviously there could be all sorts of, you know, implications and difficulties in providers providing data in standard form. But we could presumably make a recommendation that we think ICANN should explore with the providers gathering the data on URS cases in a standard form so that, you know, future reviews are easier to conduct. Could we consider making that, you know, capturing that recommendation now as something we think is worth making?
I certainly see no reason why we can't, Susan. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this point? George.
George Krikos for the transcript. Yeah, I've been advocating exactly that for at least a decade now with regards to the EDRP, and obviously it applies to the ERS. The community can come up with a standard XML format for publication of decisions that would have all the relevant fields, and the providers would be expected to publish in that format. So it's not hard, but it needs to be the policy requirement to, in order to get them in line. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I am seeing general agreement with that. So if we could note that in our notes, that it appears that the recommendation, one of the recommendations that we feel like we should make at the end of this process is with regards to, at least at this stage, the ERS, that there should be standardized reports developed, and that each provider should have to provide it in a standardized format, so that, as George pointed out, we're getting the same information from everyone, and it makes it easy for researchers to look at the data and make sure we're getting the same data. Okay. George is making the point in the chat that he's not just talking about a standardized report. He's also talking about how the decisions are formatted, and he sees them in an XML format because that would make it easier to actually work with the data. Okay. Now, any more comments? Okay. So now on our agenda, what we have here is we need to look at the questions. The reason we jumped ahead, just as a point of explanation, is because Barry is not available on the 31st to provide this information. So we wanted to go ahead and get this report in front of you, because it's this type of data, along with the case review that we're going to be doing, that is going to inform or be the data that we look to answer the questions with regards to the ERS. But what we have to do, and we agreed amongst the working group, was that the standardized questions that were listed at page one of our methodology report would be up for discussion. And we need to decide on a set of questions that we believe that we're going to put towards all of these. We would look at the data, we would ask these questions with regards to each high-level topic. Susan Payne, I see your hand is up again.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted, I posted an email to the list, but it was only shortly before this call, and so you may well not have seen it, for which I apologize. But when I looked at the agenda, it seemed to me that on our last call, we didn't actually finish the discussion of the co-chair statement, which is attached further down in this document. We started a discussion of it last time, and we didn't finish that discussion. So I don't mind if we go back to that now, or if we do it after we've considered the questions, but I would like to flag that I think we haven't finished that.
Thank you very much. And I do not believe we consider that discussion to be closed. I think we were just trying to loop back and finish out this, and then we can go. I'll leave it to the working group as to how they wish to proceed. Do you all want to continue on with the flushing out in the next 34 minutes these standardized questions and seeing if we can come up with that, or would you prefer to go and finish out our discussion on the co-chair memo? If you will let me know, that would like to, yeah, it's not closed, Susan, I see, and you notice Phil is in agreement with that as well. We will have a thorough discussion of it. But I just made the point to my co-chairs that we had made a big promise to this group that we would consider these questions, and we had not gotten to that, and so I thought it was appropriate that we go through the questions, okay? So, so I look to these questions here. You see that there are five. I'd take any comments. I'll go first. I don't think question five is a good question. I mean, I think that I don't think that that's how many managed to prevail is not necessarily. I mean, it could be that they managed to prevail all for the wrong reasons. So I don't think a metric about how many prevailed is important or should come into our analysis at all. So I would strike question five altogether and not include it in any form. I see Mary, your hand is up.
Yes, Jay Scott, Mary from staff here. Just to this specific question, this was included in the high-level questions or the standardized questions for the simple reason that it was suggested during the working group call where the idea of having standardized questions was discussed, and it was also suggested within the context actually of one of the more specific charter questions. So while staff included this as question five in the high-level questions, because it was suggested within the timing of that call, it was also suggested within the context of a specific charter question. So it may well be that this particular question could only apply to some or a few of the topics, but not all, perhaps in contrast with the other four, which were all suggested as a series of specific high-level questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see Rebecca's hand has come up. Rebecca?
Hi, Rebecca Tushnet. I think this is a basic data gathering question. I don't really understand why, if we're asking, has this been used, we wouldn't want to know, and what happened when it was used. If we want to reword it to, you know, what happened, but it's probably counting is literally the only thing we're going to be able to agree on. So I don't see why we wouldn't actually try and do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. I think I'm a little, personally, this is Jay Scott Evans, I'm a little confused. I had talked about question five. I'm not, and you mentioned question one. I know there's some discussion going on in the tech, in the chat box about question one, but I'm a little confused. Are you talking to question five and my comments about how many you managed to prevail? Or?
Rebecca, oh, sorry. Can I please finish?
Go ahead.
Yes. So I understood question five to be sort of what happened with whatever we're talking about. You know, did people prevail with their complaint? Did people prevail with their response or their defense or whatever? If you want to say that's a subset of has it been used, we certainly can. Okay. But I guess I don't understand why we'd get rid of it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, then, this is J. Scott Evans for the record. Then perhaps it should say, rather than how many prevailed, given the fact that there could be different variants of what a prevail is, would a better question be, what was the ultimate outcome? Any thoughts? I'm seeing some agreement in the chat. Is there anybody who disagrees with question five being, and what was the ultimate outcome? George.
Yeah, George Griggs here. It might be helpful for people to open up two different windows, like have page one of the document so they can see the five questions, and then scroll the rest of the document to see the various issues. I don't see how even this new question would apply to many of these topics, to be honest. So I'm just puzzled. Like, obviously, the original question doesn't apply to many of these topics, but even this modified one, how do you talk about prevailing with regards to, for example, education or evaluation of the URS providers and things like that. So unless you only want to apply the question to a subset of the topics, but then that kind of raises the question whether it should be a column that's orthogonal to these issues at all. Thanks.
Thank you very much, George. So that's the reason we need to consider this. And it may be that all five questions wouldn't be applied to each topic. It may be that, one or two questions would apply depending on what the particular topic is. So I just threw things out. So let's just put a placeholder to get the discussion started that it looks like where it would be relevant, the better question for five would be, what was the ultimate outcome? So with regards to the other questions, I think George makes a good point. We need to look at the type of standard questions that we might ask about. I mean, I think this is from my personal opinion. I'm not sure. I think, has it been used? If there's been a response filed and a complaint filed, answers itself. But that may be a very good question with regards to defenses. So, I mean, I'm just thinking we've got to think about this and how we want to structure this, and it's to the group to help guide this. And so I look to you, and I think Rebecca's point is well taken, that when she said, well, there may be subsets to questions under has it been used, but we just need to decide, on a set of questions. And it can be that we have, let's say we ultimately decide that there are going to be eight questions, and not each question would be asked against every point, every upper topic, but they are the eight questions we'd ask. We might ask question 1, 5, and 3 of certain topics, 4, 2, and 6 against others, 1 through 7, giving others depending if they are appropriate. But I need some guidance, and we as co-chairs need guidance from the working group about how they'd like to proceed and what questions they feel are valuable to ask against these topics in a way that is content neutral, objective, and allows us to look at the data both that Barry's putting together and the cases and extrapolate answers to those questions based on the data that we have in front of us. So that's the purpose of this exercise. We have 25 minutes left. Any comments? Kathy, and then Claudia.
Thank you, Scott. This is Kathy, and you've seen it in the chat, so let's put it out. So for question number one, has it been used? The follow-up, and we've done it in any number of data subteams and data sets, has it been used? If not, why not? These things are created. It's a new, URS is a new system. If something's not being used, why not? It will give us a better idea of whether things are understood, whether they're not understood, whether they're superfluous. So, again, it's on the table. It's in the chat. Has it been used? If not, why not? Thanks.
Okay. Are there others who – Claudia.
Yeah. So I agree with that. And also what George put in the chat about 2, 3, and 4 being sort of correlated to each other. And when we say original purpose, I'm presuming we mean the original purpose of the provision within the URS, not the URS as a mechanism. And if that's the case, I think, J. Scott, the way you described it is, I think we need to be flexible and decide which questions would be applicable to the topics. I think they do capture most of the issues we're going to be examining. My question was, in particular, when we say, are we making a presumption that the original purpose of a specific provision is valid, or is it possible that in light of experience, there was something baked into the URS that we now realize that should be modified in some way. And I just wanted to make sure that was captured. My concern is that if we proceed on the basis that all of the original provisions within the URS, that there's some sort of presumption that those should remain. I don't think that's necessarily correct. I think it's possible that we might want to change some of the provisions within the URS. So I just wanted to make sure that was captured. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Claudio. Phil Corwin, I think I see your hand next.
Yeah, thanks, J. Scott. Phil, for the record, personal comments. I just would say that in applying these questions, and whether we have 5 or 7 or 8 or whatever, that we just should acknowledge that they're going to have to be selectively and kind of flexibly apply to the different questions below in the table. So, for example, when you ask, has it been used, in some cases that's going to be very easy to answer. If you're talking about duration of suspension period, you said, yeah, in every case where there was a suspension, it was for the remainder of the original registration period. That's taken as granted, whereas in under D1 standard of proof, has it been used? Well, we hope it's been used, but without some further inquiry as to the actual determination of URS cases, we can't be sure that it's been used in all cases and that shades of gray cases have gotten through. Similarly, asking how it has it been used doesn't apply at all for something like point number one under remedies, whether there should be additional remedies such as a perpetual block. That would the consideration of those remedies would stem more from the questions regarding whether there's been unintended consequences of only having suspension as a remedy, and whether adding other things would better align the proposed additional remedies with the original purpose and intent. So I'm just saying, you know, it's great to have an overarching kind of question framework for the more detailed policy questions if we just all acknowledge that in some cases the answers. That hurt.
Is everybody there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Well, just to reiterate the point, in some cases a question will be very applicable to one of those policy inquiries. In some cases, it's not going to be relevant. In some cases, the answer is going to be very easy to find. In other cases, it's going to. My poor left ear. And finally, in some cases, questions like has it been used won't apply at all to suggestions for new remedies or other new features of URS. So I'll stop there. I hope if we can just agree on flexible and selective application of these overarching questions, I think we'll be able to work with them. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Phil. Kathy?
Just Scott, if you want to respond to Phil's point, I'd be happy to listen because I was going to go on to something more detailed.
Well, I mean, I think he made the same point that I made earlier, which was that it may be that not every one of these questions is apropos to every one of the high-level topics, and we need to decide when we look at a topic which of those questions we believe are apropos. I think George has pointed out in the chat that questions 2, 3, and 4 seem to be aligned that they could be asked against, and George, correct me if I'm wrong, they could be asked against most of the high-level topics. What was the original purpose, and is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? and what changes could better align the mechanism if the answer to question three is yes, there have been unintended consequences, what changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose or facilitate it to carry out its purpose? In other words, that would be a recommendation, I think. If George is going to respond to what I pointed out from the chat, if that's okay, Kathy, I'd like to go to him first, and then I'll come back to you.
Sure, I'll stay in the queue. Thanks.
George Grigos again for the transcript. Yeah, if you look at 2, 3, and 4, yeah, they are, as you said, consistent with one another. If you look at question number 2 in particular, it's a compound question. It asks, what was the original purpose? That's a question. And then conceivably you could break it out into a separate question. Is it being fulfilled? And so that could kind of reorder the columns, per se, if we consider these to be columns and then all the issues to be rows in a table. And then if you look at number 1, I think Rebecca made a good point earlier about perhaps rephrasing that. And one suggestion, as I pointed out earlier, is do we have data or experience on this topic? And that could kind of go into right after the first part of number 2. So what was the original purpose? And then do we have data or experience on this topic? And so that's kind of a data collection exercise. And then if you look at the second part of the current number 2, is it being fulfilled? And that's based on, obviously, the data or the experience of that process. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Kathy?
Yeah, I had a question for you and Heather. I understand you're the drafters of these. On what you meant by original purpose, as you pointed out and as George pointed out, it's in 3 different questions, 2, 3, and 4. And how, you know, what was the original purpose? May be in the eye of the beholder on some of this. As a person on the SCI drafting team, I thought the original purpose was creating fair and balanced procedures for trademark owners and registrants to handle clear-cut cases of abuse in the new GTODs on an expedited basis. But it sounds like something, especially if it's in 3 questions, that we should think about how we're going to address. And so I wanted to know what you were thinking of and what Heather was thinking of as original purpose and how together the working group arrived at kind of a broader definition, especially if we're putting it into 3 questions. Thanks.
Okay. This is J. Scott Evans for the record. First of all, I didn't draft any of this. I saw it the first day the rest of you did. I was on the call in November when this was discussed. And as Mary has pointed out, the 5 questions were merely extrapolated from the discussions that occurred during the call when this methodology first came up as an example. They were given it as an example of how they would do and in a way that they thought would ease the burden of our work without having to go through each chart of question and wordsmith it. So I think that was, she made those questions on the fly. That's been said over and over again. So I think what we're trying to do now is decide whether those questions that came up on the fly are appropriate, or as we give a more thoughtful look at it after we've adapted and decided, we've adopted and decided we like this methodology, what questions, keeping in mind the general concept, are appropriate. So that's the purpose of this exercise. It's not to defend any of these questions. It's to ask the group as they consider them if they believe they're appropriate or if they do not believe they're appropriate, if they believe that there are other questions or different questions that need to be put forth. Kathy.
Terrific, Jessica. I appreciate it. It's not an accusation. I just thought I saw in Mary's notes several references to the fact that you and Heather had drafted this. So if that's not the case, that's great. And it looks like Heather's in the chat talking about what she might have meant by original purpose. But I think it's something we have to dive into so that we don't wind up with original purpose having different meanings. Thanks.
Susan Payne.
Yeah, hi.
I mean, we've got a charter which we could all just go back and look at. I did try to put it in the chat, but I'm afraid it came out horribly formatted. But, I mean, it's in the background section, and it talks about, you know, as a result of the new GTLD program, several new rights protection mechanisms were developed to mitigate potential risks and costs to trademark holders that could arise in the expansion of the GTLD namespace. Included certain safeguards to protect registrants from engaging with legitimate uses of domain names. I mean, isn't that the legitimate purpose? I mean, this was meant to be a process that stopped us, you know, painstakingly wordsmithing the individual charter questions so that we could just get on and actually do the job we're here for. And we just go round in circles every week. This is so frustrating.
Thank you, Susan. Any other? This is J. Scott Evans speaking for the record. As I look at these questions, I don't think that question five, no matter how it's worded, applies to everything. I don't think question one, as it currently written, even with an if not, why not, sub-question applies to everything. I do think I agree with George that 2, 3, and 4 seem to have alignment, and they seem to align together. I think that we could use question one in certain areas, and we can agree on that when we get there. Like I said before, I perfectly agree that defenses may be a question that would be appropriate for. Appeals might be one that's appropriate and could be used. With regards to remedies, the extension of the suspension, has it been used, is another one that I think, has it been used, applies to. So I think that those are ones that would apply in certain instances. I think 2, 3, 4 apply. Now, when we look at something and we ask the question, what was the original purpose, it may be that part of this process is we have to come to a group and decide what that original purpose was. Right? We have to say, based on our discussions, we extrapolated, we looked at the IRT report, we looked at the SITI report, we believe the original purpose was X. Applying that to this, here's the question. You know, and I don't think it's Kathy, you went way up to the original purpose of what the URS is. I think this is much more granular. What was the original purpose of allowing there to be a 6-month window for someone to be able to come up and bring an action after a default? What was the original purpose of there being allowed a year for there to be an appeal? Those are the kinds of questions I think we're asking about the mechanics of it and why it works, why it was written the way it was, and is that fulfilling its purpose, right? So that's sort of how I see it, rather than asking the question with regards to the URS. I'm talking about looking at those topics and how they are and the issues that are under those topics and asking those questions to it. I'm just trying to explain the methodology so that we know how these need to be due. Let's go to Claudio, and then we'll go to Paul McGrady.
Thanks, Jay Scott. And I agree with your interpretation there. My only comment was, if we are looking at the original purpose, let's say question number 3, for example, and we find that there have been some unintended consequences, question 4 seems to just bring us back to the original purpose again. It says what changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose, facilitate it to carry out its purpose. So I'm just a little unclear that when we find, if there is any unintended consequences, does question 4, is question 4 drafted in a way that allows us to basically say we need to make certain changes to the policy, and we might have to deviate from the original purpose. And maybe that's just another question that we could add or modify question four in some way. And just looking at it, it just seems that there's a presumption made that the original purpose is sort of valid, and we shouldn't be straying from it. That was really my only point. Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. So I see that as, this is J. Scott Evans for the record, perhaps a question we ask, is the original purpose still relevant? So something in that line. I mean, that's a sub-question we get to when we ask these questions. I don't know. Paul?
Thanks, J. Scott. Paul McGrady for the record. So I think just to sort of recap what we've talked about, I think one will be answered in two. What was the original purpose and has it been fulfilled? So I'll use an example of the 1 year for appeal. If we're getting back to this, the original purpose was to provide a reasonable amount of time for an appeal, but it's not being fulfilled because it actually takes 2 years, not 1 year, to do an appeal, then, you know, question number one may be answered, because if it actually takes 2 years, nobody can do it in 1 year, then nobody will have appealed, right? So I think one will come out in the wash. Five, as modified, what were the ultimate outcomes? Again, I think that there's sort of two kinds of outcomes. One is what was intended by the original purpose, and I don't think anybody – Claudio's raised an issue about the legitimacy of the original purpose. I'm not sure that, we have a lot of time and stomach to go back and take too much of a look at that, but maybe some do. But I think most of the time we'll say, okay, if it sort of worked itself out in the way that the drafters intended, fine. But if it didn't work itself out in the way that the drafters intended and there's an unintended consequence, then that sort of answers the question about what were the ultimate outcomes, right? So five, I think we can scrap one and five because they'll work themselves out in two, three, and four. I think that leaves us with, what was the original purpose, and is it being fulfilled? Bearing in mind the original purpose, have there been any unintended consequences? What changes could be better aligned, could better align the mechanisms with the original purpose, facilitate it to carry out its purpose? And then the next question would be, is the original purpose still relevant? And if not, what should be the purpose of the mechanism, and should the mechanism be retained or refined? Something along those lines. And then I think we have a very sharp tool here to go through and evaluate these, and that will allow us to move forward. There's been some chatter in the chat about frustration, but I actually think that this back and forth in the conversation has led us to a pretty good point of taking these initial straw man questions, and I hate to use that word because it's so loaded and I can't land, but taking these initial drafts and really coming to, I think, some good thoughts about the purpose, the relevancy of the purpose, whether or not the purposes are being fulfilled, and any kind of wackadoodle outcomes, because we should be worried about those. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Kathy?
I actually think I'm understanding the five questions a lot better. So with the modifications, I think one and five actually do contribute a lot. And the original purpose is applied to the mechanisms, mechanics. We're looking at everything in the abstract, but J. Scott, what you said about applying it to the mechanics of the response, the complaint, the appeal, that also makes a lot of sense. So I think the five questions as drafted, with the modifications we discussed today, actually makes sense. And I just wanted to add, of course, we're still keeping in light the charter questions. They're kind of in the deep background, but they're what kind of drove the creation of the URS review topics and these high-level questions. So they're still there as well, kind of prodding us on some specific issues that were of concern to people when they were drafting the charter. So I think the five questions make sense. Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay, we've got about 3 minutes left. So far, I haven't heard Susan Peng.
Yeah, just a quick point. Noting what Kathy just said and the status of the original charter question, could we just have a note, please, to the effect that we all acknowledge that the original charter questions are horribly biased in their drafting, and that we've decided not to go through an exercise of redrafting them painstakingly, so that we recognize that, so that we later down the line don't start referring back to them or saying that some topics are out of scope because they're not specifically captured in a particularly biased draft charter question.
Thank you. Antoinette? Oh, I'm sorry, you just dropped, you came up to the top of the list. I see your hand is not up. Phil?
Yeah, thanks, J. Scott. I'll be brief in the interest of time. Yeah, you know, following up on Susan, I think, you know, we can get some agreement on these top-level questions, then we can probably free up a lot of time we might spend arguing over the precise wording of the charter questions. For example, on G1, how can the appeals process of the ERS be expanded and improved? That kind of presumes that there needs to be expansion and improvement. If we just say we're going to address the appeals process and look at how it's been used and whether it's being used in, you know, to achieve the original purpose and whether there's unintended consequences, we could save a lot of, if we could all agree that we're not kind of freed up from endless back and forth about modifying that question and we're just going to focus on the appeal process and how it's working, is it achieving its purpose, did things pop up we didn't expect, we can save an awful lot of time that would otherwise be expended on endless back and forth about precise wording of these questions. So I hope we can do so. Thank you.
Thank you. So where I see us now, and I want to summarize it for the record, this is J. Scott Evans, is that while there are some that think 1 in 5 may not be applicable to everything, there are those that believe that they have value. So the 1 through 5, I do believe I heard both Claudio and Paul suggest that we might want to ask another question, and I would suggest that it be inserted between current questions 3 and 4, and that is, you ask the question, have there been any unintended consequences? And then we have a question with regards to whether the original purpose is still relevant. And if the answer is no, then you move to, we could modify what changes could better align the mechanism with the original purpose or facilitate to carry out this purpose, or should there be a new purpose, you know, something in that way. So we leave our way to say that, you know, that if there should be a new purpose or we realize, you know, there should be changes, we capture that that's also something that we can do. We're right at the hour, so Jeff has not spoken at all, so I'm going to go to Jeff and then quickly Kathy, and then I'll let you close us out.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff, and I haven't spoken, but on this one, I think it's very dangerous to talk about if the original purpose is still relevant, because then my fears will get backtracked into an argument of whether intellectual property rights deserve to be protected at all versus free speech and all stuff. I let's use some caution. Let's stick with these 5 and then think about it a little bit more as to whether we talk about whether the original purpose is still relevant, because we can go down a big rat hole. Thanks.
I see Kathy agrees with that. Kathy?
I was in the queue to invoke Jeff Newman's rule that we don't go too far afield from, if there's no problem, we don't rewrite things. So in agreement with Jeff. Thanks.
Okay. Paul says he's flexible, so I say at this point, what I'm hearing, the greatest amount of agreement on is we just keep the five questions as they are. I think Rebecca has asked in the chat if, in one, we could ask the why or not, why or why not. So has it been used? If not, why not? You know, we can some form of that question in one. So I would ask that staff do us a favor of recirculating this, but breaking out these questions with any suggestions that they sift through the minutes and can advise that we need that have been suggested we make. We put those to the group on the list, and we solve this on the list. And so by the time we come back, we have 2 weeks. By the time we come back on the 31st, we've resolved the issues with regards to those questions, and we can move on to dealing with data gathering so that then we can look at the data, apply these questions to it, look at the each high-level area, and move on with our work. So one more time, the 31st will be the Asia-Pacific call, and that will be circulated to everyone, and so you'll know that as well. And with that, I'm going to thank everyone today for their participation. I think we made great progress, and I appreciate everyone for their thoughts, and we look forward to speaking to you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned.